In this session, we'll continue on slide 12. So there's our overview of the thing. Now let's start looking at some of these regions separately. Like, for example, at the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, we have what is called Mount Arbel. Arbel is a peak that is the highest peak that overlooks the Sea of Galilee. In this picture, you'll see the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee below. And that's pretty fascinating. I mean, the Bible looks very, very flat until you actually go visit there or you see some good pictures. I've taken lots of pictures in Israel, but I find that the other pictures that other people have taken, especially aerial pictures, are a lot better. So this would be, we're on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee here, and we're looking eastward over toward Jordan. And Mount Arbel is a high peak that looks down on the lake. Once you get down on the lake, then you actually will see a three-part place right here on the northern side of the Sea of Galilee. A white building, which looked quite strange, honestly, because there's black basalt in the whole region. The whole region has black stones in the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. But here's this white limestone synagogue. How did they do that? These people in the second century brought in from a long, long way, they brought all this white stone in here because they wanted this place, this synagogue, to be bright. Instead of using the black stone. Actually, it's built over the synagogue of the first century. And I'd have to check to find out, was that in white limestone stone as well? But in any case, it's a reminder to me that what Isaiah 9 says, that people living in darkness has seen a light to the Gentiles. And here's Jesus picking this place, the bright white limestone synagogue, to be the focus of his ministry. This is the synagogue that Jesus preached in Capernaum, with all this black stone all around it.
These photos are taken by you.
This one is probably taken by a drone. This is an aerial picture here. Between the synagogue and the Sea of Galilee is an octagonal, this eight-shaped side building. This is actually a Catholic church built over Peter's house. So Peter lived right next to the synagogue. And then, of course, right next to Peter's house, you have the harbor. So we've got Peter's place of work, his home, and his church, so to speak. His place of worship, rest, and work, all on the same street. In other words, Peter didn't have a long commute. Peter was like me. I teach at Singapore Bible College in Block 1. I live in Block 2. And my office is in Block 7, which is right next to Block 1. It's like my whole life is just kind of right there. And then our church is, it's just the next freeway exit, expressway exit over. It saves me so much time. Travel time. I used to have a 1 hour commute to the Bible college every day, a 1 hour commute home. My life is so much more effective. I save 2 hours. I have two more hours of work opportunity available by doing that. Peter was like that as well. You're welcome to take any photos of these, but I think I'll just keep going because you can download these all from the website, and you'll get a better. You'll get a better picture if you just download this presentation on the... This is presentation 26 of the geography of the ancient Near East. So you're welcome to. All of these are available. This is the south shore of the Sea of Galilee. Sea of Galilee is a beautiful, beautiful place. And Israel has done a remarkable job of using the water there for irrigation. So there's all kinds of crops there. And so this is the northern part. Now, speaking of the mountains, So here are our various mountains. I didn't put Mount Arbel up here because that would be another one here. But Israel is a land with a lot of variety in it in respect to the terrain. Many countries are like that. Sri Lanka is like that. You know, you've got the mountains up in Kandy, and you've got the ocean, seashore, you know, your coastal regions. There's a lot of variety here in this place. On one of my trips, I'm going to bring my wife and stay another week or month or something like that. And we're actually going to be able to see your place. This is my 15th time to Sri Lanka. But I'll tell you what I do when I come. I'm working on so many of my things, approving my students' dissertations back home. That's what I was doing last night. You know, and spending most of my time teaching and preparing and all that. I want to really enjoy your country a little bit more. So maybe my wife can come with me and we can slow down a little bit next time. So you've got Mount Hermon, the highest place in all of Israel. Up in Mount Hermon, you can you can ski. And you better be careful because people might want to take your life. So instead of having ski poles, maybe it's good to have a machine gun, huh? Don't see skiers with machine guns too often. So that's Mount Hermon up at the top. Mount Carmel? This one. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. And it snows all year round. So here's where the source of water comes that feeds on into the Sea of Galilee. Mount Hermon is so high that it's used in Psalm 133. Do you remember Psalm 133 about unity? Blessed is it when brothers live together in unity. It's like the dew of Hermon landing on Mount Zion. Now think about that. Does the dew from Mount Hermon land on Mount Zion? Zion is Jerusalem. You don't find dew coming down, you know, going all the way over the whole country to get to the south down to Jerusalem. But that's the point of the psalm. The psalm is like, if you understand the geography of it, you can understand the point of the psalmist. Unity's like that. Unity just sort of permeates the whole land. The blessing of water, of dew from one place just kind of covers over the whole land. It's what I experience with you. You know, I come from America. It's a long way away. It's 12 time zones away right now. That's the other side of the world. But unity that we experience in Jesus, it crosses from the entire Pacific, it goes to Singapore, and then it pushes me on out here to be with you. It's a beautiful thing. It's like the dew that I experienced in the United States comes to permeate all the way down here to Colombo. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So if you understand where these places are, it'll give you insight into these passages like Psalm 133. You'll understand, if you understand that Mount Carmel is up here at the coast, very close to Phoenicia. And who did they worship up at Phoenicia? This was the place of Baal. Baal, B-A-A-L. This is the center of Baal worship, Baal worship. 1 Kings 18. Elijah goes up to Mount Carmel. You see the point of the passage now? And Baal is the god of rain. Okay? Elijah has gone to Baal country. He's in his territory. Do you think the god of rain should be able to create rain in his own territory? Well, he should, right? If he's truly the god of rain. But this is a slap in the face of Baal for Elijah to go to Mount Carmel. Because there at Mount Carmel, he shows Yahweh is the God of the whole world. There's no such thing as these local deities. Your God of rain can't even create rain in his own backyard. God, Yahweh, one prophet, Elijah, is of the true God is better than 450 prophets of Baal and another 400 prophets of Asherah, his wife, Baal's wife. You got 850 of you in your own home area because Baal worship had infiltrated Israel down to Mount Carmel. You catch the point? If you understand the geography of it, that then the text becomes, it comes alive. It'd be like you going in into a Buddhist or a Hindu area where they claim that their deity is very, very strong, and you say, no, no, no. I worship Jesus. Jesus is ruler. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to him. And Jesus' name is more powerful than the greatest strongholds of the enemies. You know what I'm talking about, right? You just know the geography of Sri Lanka better than I do. You could illustrate it from your own cultural context. Mount Gilboa, also another significant place, not mentioned in a whole lot of places, but this is where Gilboa was, where Saul died on Mount Gilboa. Interesting, Mount Gilboa, David cursed it and said, may there be no dew or rain there. And for 3,000 years, Mount Gilboa was basically just a barren hill until in the last few decades, Israel has brought in water and they've been growing crops there. But anyway, Mount Tabor is a mountain where when Barak and Deborah were fighting against Sisera, they hid up on this mountain behind all the trees there. How would you hide an army except to have an army up there in the hill? They knew the hill was there, the hill of Tabor or Mount Tabor, but they didn't realize that there was 10,000 men up there. And they rushed on down, and there was a great victory. Judges 4 and 5 talks about that. Some brothers died on Nebo and Hor. Who are they? Who died on Mount Nebo?
Moses.
This is the closest Moses got to the land over on the other side. And who died on Hor? His brother? Aaron. So both of these guys dying on mountains. Maybe someday I'll die on a mountain. We'll see. I don't know. Jesus was last seen on a mount, Mount of Olives. And he said, when he left, when I come back, I'm going to come back to the mountain. It's appropriate that Jesus came and left from a mountain when you think about it. It's when his glory was seen the most on a mountain as well, whether Mount Tabor at the Transfiguration or up higher, Mount Hermon or something. We don't really know. But anyway, that's a little bit about Mount Hermon. And you have on page 18 this elevation map that will give you just a taste of the huge diversity there is in Israel in terms of topography. Going from very, very high up at Mount Tabor, Upper Galilee. This one actually doesn't even show it in the cross section. But Mount Hermon is more like 9,000, 10,000 feet. Goes up twice as high as these. And you'll see how the Jezreel Valley is so low. Jezreel Valley would be right in here, in the middle part, just to the southwest of the Sea of Galilee. All right. So let's look at these divisions. You'll see also on that page, there are north-south divisions. You'll see five of them listed there that can help us to understand about the culture of Israel. The coastal plain was the first one, is the first one still. It's a flat area of Israel. Not all coasts are flat. You often have high cliffs, you know, dropping off. But in Israel's case, with the exception of Mount Carmel, it's pretty much a flat coastal area. And where you have flat areas, you have people able to run their chariots. So the Egyptians were able to come into this area with their chariots and control this area. Same thing for Canaanites who had iron chariots. This is a wooden Egyptian chariot here that you see the picture of. But the coastal plain was a place where it was flat, and therefore the place where you wanted to, wherever you have the flat areas, there's where you normally are going to have your main road going north-south through those areas. And so that's what we actually see happening there. The main north-south road would go through there. And some being on the coast, you're going to find a trade, for example, in the city of Tyre, farther up north. Tyre was the greatest mercantile or greatest city of the world for trade. Just about all kinds of goods you can find anywhere in the ancient world, you'd find in Tyre. Because these people had the ships and they had the trade all going through Tyre. It's a good depiction of Satan and all of Satan's beauty that God gave him as the highest of the various angels. A modern city that's only about 100 years old is Tel Aviv. Do you know Tel Aviv was just a flat, barren area 100 years ago. But Israel has developed it significantly, and so it is a modern, well-known city with a fantastic airport, etc. Most people flying in to Israel will fly into Tel Aviv today. And yet, from Israel's standpoint, there's nothing could change the fact that Jerusalem is their ancient capital. It has been for 3,000 years. And so this is where the politics come in, all this. Most countries of the world do not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. They recognize Tel Aviv. That's true for Sri Lanka too, is it not?
Yes.
Yeah, so Sri Lanka's in the... U.S. is more confrontational on this sort of thing. The U.S. perspective is every country should be able to determine their own capital. Say, what city is their capital? So that's the philosophy the U.S. has. If Israel says Jerusalem is their capital, under President Trump, they moved the embassy over to Jerusalem. Caesarea it's like Tel Aviv in the sense that it's on the coast, and it was also just carved out of the coast. No source of water there, and so they had an aqueduct that came from Mount Carmel. Several kilometers, the Romans built an aqueduct in there, and they basically made a harbor for Caesarea. They named it after Caesar, and from the Roman standpoint, Caesarea was a crowning achievement in Israel because they built such a beautiful city. The Jews despised it, though, because they saw it as the center of the Roman armies. And this aqueduct was so effectively built that much of it survives today. That brought the water right along the fresh water from Mount Carmel down to Caesarea. Gaza was the ancient Philistine city, also on the coast. And Gaza became the name of our modern-day Gaza Strip. Of the five Philistine cities there, Gaza was the one that... So the present Gaza Strip is in the area of ancient Gaza, and it is a larger area that covers the land of the Philistines. So the Palestinians who live in the area of Gaza are occupying basically the very much the area of the Philistines at the time of David. So that covers the coastal plain. The second north-south division here is the Shephelah, or the foothills. Shephelah means this area is with lots of hills and valleys, and is a very, very fertile area because of the soil, and it's right off the main road, so it's not, you don't have the main road going right through it. So that's the second one. The third of the three of the five major areas is the central mountain range, or some would call it the central mountain spine, sort of like the spine in your body. It's sort of as where everything's connected. And the central mountain range notes that you basically have mountains in the south, and you also have mountains in the north in this central area. Galilean mountains in the north, Judean mountains in the south. So the Judean hills, where Jerusalem was located, is within the central mountain range, and it's pretty much an uninterrupted range until you get to the Jezreel Valley that interrupts it at the top before it continues up into the Galilean mountains. Jezreel, named after the city of Jezreel, or also known as the Plain of Megiddo, named after the city, the main city there called Megiddo, where the north-south trade route would come and have to come through the city of Megiddo. In that very flat area, one of the bread baskets of Israel where the crops were grown, you have Mount Tabor. So this is the background, this is understanding Judges 4 and 5, where we see the forces of Deborah and Barak up there in the hills defeating Sisera when they come on down. So basically, since you've got this mountain spine, it's a mountainous area in the middle, any drop of water that goes and hits the center of Israel, it's either going to end up in the Mediterranean Sea on the west, or it's going to end up down at the Sea of Galilee, or the Jordan River ending up down at the Dead Sea. So this ridge causes water to flow either east or west. So you find the terrain here has deep grooves in it that go east-west, meaning that it's very difficult to travel Israel if you're up in the mountains. You have to basically stay along the mountain range, because otherwise you're going to get into these huge valleys that have been carved over centuries and centuries of water flowing to the east or the west. And the higher elevation is here in the south. So even those who lived in the mountains of the north, they would still say, let us go up to Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem was in the Judean hills in the higher part of Israel, which is very much like, well, the heart of man, is it not? Isn't it the case here in Sri Lanka, people think of that you go up to worship, you don't go down in a valley to worship, do you? Whether from a Christian or a pagan idea. I know that the Temple of the Sacred Tooth of Buddha is up there in Kandy. So, one of the higher places you've got here in Sri Lanka, right? Sripad? Yeah, but this is all a Buddhist place of worship, right? Or a Hindu place of worship. There's something in us that says that God is dwelling higher than us. We must go up to worship Him. And that's not a concept that's it's unfamiliar to the Jews as well as the Canaanites. They all have their high places where people would go up to these higher places to worship. Maybe Christians do the same thing when we built these tall cathedrals, so that the highest place in a city would be the Christian church.
Buddhists are building their statues and all high.
The Buddhists have stopped building their statues in the high places?
No,
started building, yeah.
No, no,
Yeah. So there's, I don't know, I guess there's something innate in us to think where we think that we need to do that. Isn't it wonderful to be able to worship Jesus anywhere, though? So the wilderness of Judea then would be in the very, very barren area. And here's where Jesus was tempted. So our wilderness of Judea would be basically between Jerusalem and Jericho. So that's the third. Here's the fourth of the north-south divisions called the Jordan Rift. Do you remember what the other three were? What was the one on the far left? Coastal plain. And then the second one? Or you could just say foothills or Shephelah. The middle? Central Mountain. Yeah, Central Mountain Ridge. Now we're to number four, the Jordan Rift. Jordan Rift is a deep, like a carving. It's almost like some have said God, he just put his hand down and he just scooped out a lot of dirt starting from the Sea of Galilee all the way through the Jordan River down to the Jordan, to the Dead Sea, and even farther south. Even farther south down into the Red Sea, it's deeper in the Red Sea there as well. It's like, yeah, God was just playing with the earth or something like that. And here's where we go to deep depression. Especially when you get to the Sea of Galilee, which is the lowest of them all. So here's from the wilderness of Judea, looking east to the salt sea below. They say if you have deep depression, you shouldn't go into deep depression, right? Especially if you have a heart condition, you shouldn't be that low, because that's the lowest part of the world. And then on the other side of the Jordan Rift, you have the Trans-Jordan. It's on the across the Jordan, so they call it Trans-Jordan Plateau. The Trans-Jordan Plateau is a high ridge that includes Mount Nebo, where it is a very convenient place to look on over on a clear day, look over all of Israel, as Moses did when God gave him an opportunity from Mount Nebo to look and to see all of these. All right, so let's see. Could you do it? Could you go through the five divisions? Let's pair up again. Go through the five divisions of the land of Israel, okay? Just do that with your partner and see if you remember them all. All right, I've got to get to test you again. Can you do it without looking at your notes? Starting on the left. That area along the water there.
According to this, is it
Jordan? Yeah, the farthest left area. It's easy to remember it because it's on the coast. Yeah. And what kind of coast is it? What's the terrain like at the coast? Is it mountainous or is it flat? This was the flat area, the coastal plain. There's a coastal plain, the easy area to travel. So that's where the main trade route went. I should have shown you guys a picture of the trade route going through there. Maybe I'll do that when I edit this. The next would be the foothills or the Shephelah, rolling plains there of farmland. How about in the middle? Very good. Yeah. Central Mountains. And then number four. Once we get along the Jordan, yeah. And what kind of area is the Jordan? Yeah. It's, I probably didn't explain the idea of rift, R-I-F-T. Rift is a low level, flat area.
So,
yeah, Jordan Rift. Jordan Rift. And then the last one? Across from the Jordan? Transjordan. Transition? Yeah. Transjordan Plateau. So it should look like this. I didn't give you a picture that shows the main road going up the coastal plain. But that's, if you can just imagine the road going on up there, and it actually crosses at the city of Megiddo here, and then it goes on up. The main roads in every country go along the flat areas, don't they? That's where we travel the most. Cities tend to develop in the flat areas, not in the highest places. We have some high places, you know, we go to worship, but they end up being really not the places where people go the most. And then the second is so this is coastal plain. This is the second one is Shephelah or the foothills. Foothills. How about in the middle? Central Mountains spine or a central mountain range. And then Jordan Rift. All right. And then final? Transjordan Plateau. You got it? Now, what's the relevance of all of this? Can you think of how this geography would affect Bible interpretation? Which area of these five areas do you think Egypt wanted to control the most? The plain. Why would Egypt be concerned about controlling the plain? They wouldn't care about what's happening up in the hills.
Transport.
The Egyptians were the superpower. They wanted to make sure their caravans would come from Mesopotamia. They didn't care what was happening up here, unless there's bandits are going to come on down and interrupt their caravans. So the Egyptians wanted to make sure they had chariots. They could control this area. And there's a lot of battles over who's going to actually control the main artery of trade.
Battles with who?
The Egyptians, for example, came on up here and they fought against the the Battle of Carchemish that involved the Babylonians. Yeah, the Babylonians were conquering the Assyrians across, and they went on up to basically try to defeat the Assyrians. And they got defeated, and the Babylonians ended up taking this whole area. Babylonians were smart enough to realize that they better have that conquer the cities as well. Well, the Assyrians did the same.
So now here, this also is Transjordan side also plain?
Yeah, Transjordan over on this side was your... It was a plateau, so it was a flat area up high. So that's what Moab was like, overlooking the Sea of Galilee. Very fertile area. This whole area right here on the eastern side of the Jordan River was very fertile. And this is why when Israel came up under Moses, some of the tribes said, hey, can we just stay here? Reuben, Gad, half tribe of Manasseh, they said, hey, can we just have our allotment on this side? So, because they had such wide open areas for their livestock. Yeah, once you understand this, you can see how it's going to impact many, many different things relating to Scripture. When you understand where Hebron is, Hebron is pretty far south. David was crowned king of Hebron, right? He was king of Judah. You understand that this is the area of Judah. But when Israel wanted to make him king, would this be a good place to rule from? Way far south? You go a little bit farther, you get to Beersheba, which is the lowest of them all. It makes sense that David would be interested in shifting his capital farther to the north so he could reign over all the tribes. And so Jerusalem became a very attractive city to be in the high place, to put the temple in the high place. David wasn't interested in a temple being being over on the coastal road. He was interested in, as we all are, that this would be on the high places. Anyway, if you think about it, you could recognize, wow, there's actually a lot of implications here. And I'll share some more of those before we end for lunch. Also in the south, you've got the Negev, which is basically a dry, barren place that nobody seemed to really want to have that much interest in, except unless it had military use. Here's the burial place of Herod the Great. And that would be Negev here in the far south. So, what we end up with, because of that coastal road connecting Egypt to Mesopotamia and even Europe, is we ended up with a very different culture here on the west and the north, which one Bible teacher calls left stage Israel. Does that make sense? So it's on the left-hand side, and that is in contradiction to what we have on the east and the south, which is called right stage Israel. So this left stage, right stage idea of travel in ancient Israel can help us to see, in a broad sense, the two major types of cultures that we have here. Page 20 highlights this in your notes. I've written out most of the differences between left stage and right stage there. But let me go through some of them and we'll hopefully get a better idea. On left stage, you've got honey. On right stage, you've got Superman? Really? If you look closely at Superman, you'll see that he has a milk mustache, okay? We're talking about the land of milk and honey. When Israel was referred to as the land of milk and honey, I think it's really talking about two different places in Israel. You've got farmers in the land of honey on left stage Israel, and you've got herdsmen with the land of milk because of their goats able to give milk. Does that make sense? Now, why would it be called the land of milk and honey instead of the land of honey and milk? I mean, after all, we're looking at the left here, honey here, and then you go over to the right, and that's milk. Narangela, are you thinking of what I'm thinking? You're doing your hand this way. How did they read Hebrew? From right to left. So wouldn't it make sense that they would call this the land of milk and honey? They also approached the land from the right stage and they moved on over to the left stage. So they're saying, this is the land of milk. We're going to enter the land of milk first. We're going to come into the hill country area where we can have our sheep and goats, especially goats for milk. And then we'll move on over to the land of honey. We have in left stage, because the main trade route goes through there, 40 large cities. I asked my son to help me with this. He gave me a large city there, and he gives me a city of Seattle, a picture of Seattle. I think, well, Seattle's not on there. But I realize Seattle, Washington is actually on, it's on the coast, and it's on the major route going north-south through the western United States. Caesarea was a significant city in left stage because it was on that coastal road. So it had the opportunity of both land and sea trade going through Caesarea. In contrast to left stage, in respect to its large cities, you have many more small towns. So these small towns obviously had a different culture. If you're not from the city here, the capital of your country, and you're from a small town area, how many of you are from small towns? around here, Sri Lanka? All of you from city? Oh, really? Everybody grew up here in the city? Okay, you haven't?
No.
Are you from? Center part, yeah, from a small town. I'm from sort of in the middle, but the big town near me was San Francisco. So I would just go to San Francisco twice a year or something like that. But the whole culture of San Francisco didn't impact me. It was very foreign, very, very different culture. Less stage, because it had all these roads and all this trade, it was very easy. It was predictable. It's like living in Colombo compared to living in a tiny little town up in the north. Right stage Israel was exhausting. It was unpredictable. So I asked my son, give me a picture of us exhausting. So he was doing some searches. So he gave me a picture of these exhaust pipes. Okay. Do you like to be around exhaust pipes? I don't like to be around exhaust pipes. You know, this doesn't smell so good.
So actually, you're pretty easy, but you're exhausting for the more water-borne stage.
Right stage would be not so easy to live in. Just like living in a rural area is not as easy as living in the city in the sense of conveniences. It is a little bit easier in the sense of having some quietness. But
there is more trade going on.
Yes, a lot more trade in the coast.
So the things going on to the right side is less
people. Price. People didn't go to the right side unless they wanted to go to a particular town in the right stage, Israel. They didn't go to the right because, oh, hey, let's go to the right. Because we're going up to Mesopotamia. It's just more difficult.
Even Colombo is more populated than Venice because of the port we have. With the port, Colombo port.
Colombo would be a good example of a port city, but you've got major roads going north-south through Colombo as well. This helped develop other cities north of Colombo and us south of Colombo now. That's just kind of how life works. So, on the north, on left stage, you've got a lot of trade. It's noisy, it's international. I notice when I get out of Singapore, which is very much a left stage city, how quiet it is. When I get to a small town somewhere else in the world, and right stage, you've got, it's isolated, it's quiet, and you end up with more patriotism in the rural areas as well. This is true of my country. The people who are more patriotic, more committed to the United States, typically live in the rural areas. But when people get in the cities, they start becoming less patriotic. I noticed in the U.S. that the soldiers, the people who go and fight the wars, mostly come from the rural areas, not from the major cities. Is it true here as well?
Yeah.
In the cities, people don't want to defend the cities. The cities, you have all types of viewpoints and all that. And people say, there's not real patriotism that comes from the cities in most countries. This is the way culture works. There's syncretism, paganism, left stage. The cities of the world have a lot of ideas, a lot of gods worshipped. But on right stage Israel, there's a more of a religious purity. I find it interesting that the monotheistic religions, all three of them come from the desert. You ever notice that? Judaism from the desert, from Mount Sinai. Christianity from Jerusalem, where the center of Christianity is, you know, in the right stage. And Islam, coming out of Mecca, coming out of the desert.
So Galilee falls into right stage?
Galilee would be not so much right stage. It would be, well, it's kind of at a crossroads between right stage and left stage. You'll see even the main road here splits and goes two different ways. But Galilee was, it was sort of like, well, it wasn't, as it relates to Jews, Galilee we see as backward compared to Jerusalem. But it was more technologically advanced, you might say, because of the Romans going through there.
We are saying like late stage is paganism, but you know, Jerusalem, mostly Gentile people were during Jesus' time.
Most of the Gentile people in Jesus' time were up in the north, up in Galilee. So you would find in that stage it would be more, in that way it would be more left stage.
So in
up in Galilee, right stage would be Jerusalem, where they're concerned about purity and that sort of thing.
Can you repeat,
so Galilee, with its Gentile influence, would tend toward more syncretism or paganism and not such religious purity as you would find on right stage Jerusalem. In that sense, I would say Galilee would be more left stage than right stage. But it is a crossroads there. So I would be putting Galilee more in the left stage. The road veers over to the right, and it goes through Galilee because it goes up by the Sea of Galilee to continue its way all the way up to Mesopotamia. Perhaps it's helpful to think in terms of right stage being controlled by Israel for 1,650 years. So Israel was more right stage than it was left stage. You know, Israel only had left stage for about 150 years. Only under Solomon and some periods associated with Solomon, you've got Israel with chariots. You hardly ever see Israel with chariots except for the time of Solomon. The word navy does not even appear in the Old Testament. There's no such thing as an Israelite navy. They never really had the coastal area. You only find an army in Israel because they were not like some of the superpowers, like the Phoenicians, for example, who controlled the northern part, or the Egyptians, who had a bigger navy, or at least some navy at all. You end up with the Sea Peoples, whose, interestingly, their name ends with the I-A-N-S, or especially A-N-S, mostly. They're left stage. Egyptians, I-N-S, or the Philistines would be a difference in terms of I-N-N-S. But Assyrians, Babylonians, Romans, Phoenicians, even Syrians would be more left stage. Notice the ending of all those words? With the exception of Philistines.
Is it in English or?
It would be the same in other languages as well. It just wouldn't be A-N-S. If you've got an N on the end of your word, it looks like you're left stage. Whether even Roman or Philistine. On the right, you have the desert peoples, not the sea peoples. These people didn't have boats, except maybe little boats like on the Sea of Galilee, but certainly not big, powerful navies. And they are all ending with ite, Israelite, Moabite, Ammonites, Edomites. Did you notice that? I can go on and on. Amalekites, Jebusites, Hittites, all of these ites, they were basically people of the desert and the mountains here. They were not left stage people. They were right stage people. So that's our left stage, west and north, as compared to our right stage, east and south. These are different cultures. Cultures that really impacted the world of Israel. As you find distinctions between city people and rural people today, So you find the same thing's true of the Bible. And if you understand these concepts, your insight into being able to understand all the various passages of the Old Testament and even the New Testament will increase. Okay, how about real life, left stage, right stage for you and me now? Have you thought about your life a little bit as we've been going through? Do you think you live left stage or right stage? I'm normally teaching this in Singapore, so I say, in what ways is Singapore left stage for you? But let me say it this way, in what ways is Colombo left stage for you? Living in Colombo. And maybe the corollary would be, what are the most effective ways you've found to live right stage? How do you live a right stage life in a left stage city? This has certainly been a challenge for me. I've lived in Singapore almost 29 years. And you know what? I still love Jesus. So I must have had some right stage time to get my thinking and my perspective back to the Lord in one of the busiest cities in the world. They just, and I don't know about Colombo, but in Singapore, they just want you busy. They want the city to be the city that never sleeps. And I'm like, why? Why not take a break? Why not have a little bit of right stage living?
Even in Colombo, it's 24 hours, but when you go to the middle of the country, right stage, they sleep around 8:30, the shops are closed and everything.
Yeah, that's another characteristic. When you go to rural areas, people go to bed earlier. They also get up earlier too as well. They go along with the life cycle of our planet. They go along with the sun. They say, well, the sun's gone down, so we should go down. The sun's come up, we should get up. And yet when we live in the cities, and I speak as a city dweller to my fellow city dwellers here, we have to think of ways that where we can live right stage. Otherwise, we will just be pushed and pushed and pushed to left stage living, syncretistic, not committed to Jesus anymore. One of the ways that my wife and I do this is we live in central Singapore near the Botanic Gardens, which is the prettiest area of Singapore, in my opinion. It's a beautiful 150, 200-year-old gardens. It's nicely manicured. That's where we take our walks. That's where we pray. We don't run along the streets for exercise. We walk in the gardens. And when I do that, I say, hey, sweetheart, this is kind of like Adam and Eve. That's what God made for them. He made a garden for them, didn't make a city for them. He made a place where they could be refreshed in their spirit and they could walk with the Lord in the cool of the day. And for me, this is a reminder of the importance of us walking with the Lord and having time to pull back and do that. Time in God's Word, time in prayer, time fellowshipping with the people you love. These are the things that are going to sustain you for the long haul. I've been in full-time ministry for 39 years now. And believe me, I've seen lots of people come and go. Lots of people burn out. Lots of people serve the Lord with a great, great amount of energy. But it was all left stage. And they were never able to shift and have right stage time with God. It will sustain them over the long haul. So my goal is to have my life be balanced. I live left stage, so many of the things I do. I have all these projects I want to get accomplished here while I'm with you all, but also need I also know that I need really to be following the Lord with a whole heart. And that comes from right stage living. So I encourage you to think through in your own life, how's that going to happen for you? What do you need to do for that to happen? For me, it's limiting the number of trips. It's limiting my preaching. It's having realistic goals. It's getting away, nurturing my marriage, nurturing my my walk with the Lord. And these things have sustained me over the years. And I pray that God will give me a sense of balance for all the years that he wants me to serve him. If I don't have that balance, if I'm just totally right stage or totally left stage, I don't really think I'm going to be able to serve the Lord for the long haul. Easy to do it for the short term, to live out of balance, but you can't do it for the long haul because something goes awry, you know? So I pray that would not be the case for you or for me.